Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How many things does one need to be happy? In a society that values comfort and openly admires those with the means to own nice things, it's easy to believe our possessions might hold the key to contentment. Well, 10 years ago, my guest today was like a lot of Americans, working so hard to afford her cool house in an up-and-coming neighborhood that she didn't have a whole lot of time to enjoy it. So when a jarring medical diagnosis caused her to rethink the way she was living, she became fascinated by the idea of paring down what she owned and where she lived, from a three-bedroom bungalow with all the trappings to a hand-built 84-square-foot wooden house and just over 300 individual possessions, including her bed, each dish, item of clothing, artwork, tools, even her car. Dee Williams is a teacher and sustainability advocate. Her new book is called The Big Tiny, a Built It Myself memoir. Dee, welcome to Think.
Oh, hello.
I have to say, reading your book was fascinating to me because I have never before had the sense of knowing every square inch of anyone else's house besides my own. And I really got that from this book. But will you start by describing your house to those who haven't read it yet?
Well, other people have described it as a mobile gingerbread house. It's very cute. It's cedar clad on the outside. So if you were to walk up to it in the backyard, it's got a very pointy roof and it looks a little bit like a vacation cabin. It's got a nice shiny roof, a corrugated metal roof. You walk up to it and take a couple steps up, crack open the front door, and my kitchen is on the left. And I'll describe that a little bit later. And my bathroom is on the right. You take a couple of steps past my closet, and all of a sudden you're out from under what was a sleeping loft above your head when you were standing in the kitchen and next to the bathroom. So you're standing out from underneath that sleeping loft, and you're in what I call lovingly the great room, which is... smaller than like a 5x7 area rug, but it's got an 11.5-foot ceiling, so it's got this height to it, and that height is expanded even more because there's a skylight over that. So, you know, you're standing in what feels like a really huge space that's super accommodating for hanging out, reading a book, entertaining a couple of friends, and kicking back and enjoying life.
And it sounds like you have a lot of experience because of that skylight and your proximity to it within the house of just sort of noticing the world pass by above your head.
Yeah, you know, I also have a skylight over my bed. And so those two skylights really do invite this exploration of what's going on around. And most of the time, it's pretty magical. You know, you see the moon roll past the, you know, your window at night. You get to see what the weather's doing as far as rain or snow or rain again, because I live in the Pacific Northwest and it rains all the time. you know, we've got raccoons and squirrels. It's this. I live in an urban area, but there's a lot of natural wildlife out there too. And then there are my neighbors. You know, I live in a little residential area, so. You know, I get a great view of my neighbor's blue tarp that covers his motorcycle that he's been slowly restoring forever. And I get to watch the seagulls dive bomb the rubbish bins. And, you know, there's this awesome intersection of our natural human community and this really gorgeous natural community. And I like that.
I love your explanation of how you are happy enough in your home. And I guess it's actually closer to a philosophy. Can you talk about what you mean when you say it?
Yeah, you know, I think culturally we're kind of programmed to want to be happy all the time. And if we're not happy, you know, we maybe want to take some antidepressants, or we think there's something seriously wrong with our life. Our job is horrible, or our kids are a pain in the neck, or our husband's a pain in the neck, or whatever. Like, we should be happy all the time. And there are a lot of people, and I count myself in this category, that suffer unnecessarily. Because of that sense that they should be happy all the time. So one of the things that I've kind of spun for myself in my little house, because there are parts of my little house that are absolutely inconvenient, and I can tell you about those. But, you know, that maybe the idea of being happy, like sincerely, you know, super overwhelmingly happy 85% of the time is a good mark to hit, you know. A good solid B-plus average is pretty good, you know. And so, that's for me, the way that I look at it in the Big Tiny, the way that I write about that is that it's, you know, 300 days out of the year, I feel like my life knocks it out of the park. I'm warm enough. I've, been able to take a shower somewhere. I've got all of the things around me that I want and need. I feel engaged in my life in just the way that I want to. And then the other 65 days out of the year, you might hear me kvetch or complain about, you know, my house isn't warm enough, or, I don't want to wake up when it starts raining again, you know, rain on a metal roof. Folks in Texas understand that. It can get loud, you know. So, you know, I might feel like I want to complain a little bit about that. So only having 65 days out of the year to complain is a pretty damn good life. Sorry, I didn't mean to cuss. It's a pretty darn good life.
That's okay. So tell me about this. You you're sort of off the grid, right? You don't have running water, and you have a little bit of electricity from a solar panel that sits up next to the house.
That's right. Yeah, I really wanted to, you know, kind of be as contained as possible when I set out to build the house. So I don't have running water. So I don't have a shower. I jug water in so I can do dishes and wash my hands and make tea and stuff like that. And I have a composting toilet. So a part of the reason I didn't want water coming into my house was simply because then you got to figure out where does the water go. Hmm. And, our sewer systems and septic systems are a huge cost. And it requires, like, you kind of got to take roots. And I was building a house on wheels. So, you know, trying to figure that out was a little bit of a head-scratcher for me. So I just decided to forego the water and work around it. And then my electrical system is a 240-watt solar electric system that is, you know, it's plenty of electricity for me to, you know, power my lights and my laptop and my cell phone. And I actually have way more utility than I need. And, and I still, if you ask me how this thing works, I'm not at all going to be able to tell you. It's like, you know, it's a whiz bang, you know, NASA thing for me. I don't know how the sun makes electricity. It's a mystery. And I write in the book about waking up in the middle of the night in the middle of a lightning storm one time and having to go out and try to save my expensive gadget from getting electrocuted, you know. And it was very harrowing, and everything turned out okay.
You were raised in a pretty typical house. Talk about the expectations you had, like, in early adulthood for yourself and where you ought to live based on your childhood and the kinds of lives that your parents have.
Yeah, you know, so I was, I think, raised in the Midwest, a fairly typical middle-class family. We lived on a farm. And, you know, my dream was to kind of follow along in my parents' footsteps and have a nice house. And, you know, on Sundays I would make pot roast and I would have kids and a really cool husband and, you know, everything would just be perfect. Mostly we'd string lights at Christmas and nobody would ever argue, it was going to be perfect. And, as I was aging, you know, I got to be 30 and none of those things had happened. I didn't have a house. I was still renting. And most of the rentals that I had were in pretty bad shape, to be honest. I wasn't married. I had no kids. And all of a sudden, at 32, I had an opportunity to buy a house. I finally had enough of a nest egg that I could buy a house. So it was like, I got to get into that. I got to finally arrive into my adulthood, you know. and my parents are finally going to start calling me for advice once I get this house, you know.
It is interesting in this country the way marriage is one, but I think home ownership is another sort of badge of legitimacy, isn't it?
Oh, I think so. And, you know, I think as people have, you know, we get married much later, the idea of home ownership actually kind of takes precedence in a lot of ways. There are a lot of younger people, especially during the market boom, you know, it was easier to get into a house if you got a job that was even your first job and it paid well enough, you could get a loan. And that's kind of what happened to me. You know, I was able to qualify for a $250,000 loan on my state salary, which was kind of less than a school teacher But somehow the bank wanted to give me this money. And so, of course, I was going to launch myself at that.
And so you have this house, but of course you were living in Portland, which is pretty expensive. And so you got a house that needed lots of work, and that work you quickly realized needed to be done by you.
Yeah. I mean, part of the reason it needed to be done by me, besides the fact that I was fascinated by the idea of trying to like do my own plumbing, like, oh, I can do that. I didn't have the money to pay a plumber. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how-to books became the thing that I really wanted. And I was able to actually do, you know, I rewired stuff that almost worked, and I replumbed my house a couple of times after the first time failed. And, you know, I was able to figure it out a little at a time. But, you know, the thing that ended up doing is that it shifted my time from being the gal that was out backpacking and climbing and kayaking and hanging out with her friends to, you know, the woman who was, you know, running off to Home Depot or, you know, Lowe's in order to get supplies for her latest, greatest, you know, roof repair project. Hmm. And I was spending my money on things like wrenches and ladders and, you know, how-to books instead of buying really an awesome tent or really great climbing gear. Actually nice clothes. So, you know, things shifted with that house.
Mm-hmm. And along with this sort of grown-up job that you had and grown-up house that you had this really brutal commute.
Yeah, you know, I had taken a job as a hazardous waste inspector for the state of Washington, and a few years into that, they invited me to do a temporary rotation in as the unit lead. So I the problem was I had to drive 100 miles. I'd drive up from Portland, Oregon to Olympia, Washington and stay for 3 days and then drive back. And that way I could, you know, be in the office and do my office things as a supervisor and answer the phone when people called in sick and make sure people had their timesheets in. And, you know, I was definitely not supervisor material. there was a lot of, you know, tedium and, you know, risk of paper cuts that didn't really fit my personality.
Hmm. Well, things are going along and maybe things aren't perfect, but it should have been the kind of the prime of your life. And then you faint in a store and sort of assume that you'll be fine when you stand back up again. But in fact, your entire life had changed.
Yeah, it was a bit like getting the rug pulled out from underneath me. I woke up in the hospital, and I had gone in as, you know, this state worker, a climber, a homeowner, and I woke up as a cardiac care patient. I had had a heart attack, and they were running a bunch of tests. They found I had a horrible electrical problem with my heart. They implanted a defibrillator, which is kind of like a pacemaker. And they diagnosed me with congestive heart failure, and it was shocking to me because I considered myself a fairly healthy person, an active person, and I remember getting released from the hospital, and I write about this in The Big Tiny. You know, I go home, and I'm sitting in my living room looking around at all of my stuff, you know, this nice couch I'd just gotten, my artwork, you know, the things that I had worked hard to get. And the house itself, even though I loved it, I loved every inch of that house. I'd poured myself into it, but it just didn't fit anymore. Hmm.
My guest is teacher and sustainability advocate Dee Williams. Her book is called The Big Tiny, a built-it-myself memoir. We'll come back to the conversation at in just a couple of minutes. You can join it at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with teacher and sustainability advocate Dee Williams. Her new book is called The Big Tiny, a Built It Myself memoir. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Dee, after you realized that you had heart disease, you said your old house, your old life, your old work didn't quite fit anymore, all the things that you had acquired. I guess you weren't quite sure what to do with that. And then you're sitting in a doctor's waiting room and you pick up a magazine to flip through.
That's right. This was a follow-up visit, and I'm flipping through it, and I came across an article about a guy who had built a tiny house, a little tiny rolling cuckoo clock house. And I don't know what it was about that house, but it just set up inside me. And, you know, as I'm sitting there, all of a sudden, you know, the idea was, well, what if I could do that? You know, what if... You know, I could shrink everything I own to a manageable size. And I, you know, in retrospect, I think a part of that desire was I was feeling completely overwhelmed. I was feeling overwhelmed with my diagnosis, which, you know, it was very horrible and bad to hear. You know, it's a 1 to 5 year life expectancy for people that have cardiomyopathy. And, you know, I have a 30-year mortgage and, you know, I was feeling lost and all of a sudden these decisions I needed to make about who I wanted to be. Hmm. And so I'm looking at this picture of this cute, tiny house and this guy who doesn't look that much bigger than me. And I'm like, maybe I could do that. Maybe I could build a little tiny house and shrink myself and have more time and money to do everything that I wanted to do, which at the time was, you know, hang out with my friends and play with my niece and nephew and go see my brother in Iowa and, you know, hang out and do things that brought me joy. And so the house didn't really fit that, but the tiny house did.
When you say he didn't look much bigger than you, you are, in fact, and I hope that you will take this the right way, you're a tiny person physically.
I am. I'm 5'5", and I weigh about 115 pounds or so. But Jay Schaefer, the guy that built the house, you know, he's only a couple inches taller than me. He looked like a little elf. And maybe it was the house that made him look like a Keebler elf. But, you know, he looked like a slight guy and like a rock climber kind of guy. And so I was like, you know, maybe it wouldn't take that much. Maybe you don't have to be, you know, a bearded, burly carpenter in order to build a little tiny house.
So you became obsessed with meeting Jay Schaefer in person.
I did. I mean, you know, I actually stole that picture of the little house. I ripped it out of the magazine, and which I don't recommend to people, but I did. And I took it home and I pinned it up in the refrigerator. And every time I'd float through the kitchen, I would just get these happy, melty feelings. You know, it's like I could do that. You know, maybe that would work for me. And so I decided I needed to track him down and just, you know, get some more information, find out what the logistics were. How did he do it? How long did it take him? And those kinds of things. Did it really feel good? Was he, you know, did he regret his choice? Was he a flawed human? Was he a little kooky? You know, so I decided to track him down, and I found him in Iowa City, about a mile from where my brother and his family lived. So, you know, I called. This was a crazy thing back in 2004. I called directory assistance on the phone.
No Googling.
There was no Googling. Yeah, I think Google was more of a doodle then. And so I tracked him down and talked to him on the phone and hatched a plan to go to Iowa City to see my brother, but also meet this amazing small elfin man. And it was one of the coolest things in the universe to walk up to this little house that I had been dreaming about for a few weeks and thinking about whether or not it would fit me and to have a chance to. I remember kind of like walking around the house, this cedar-clad house, you know, looked like a little cabin, and walking around it and kind of nuzzling it like it was a horse, you know, like, you know, I wanted to have my picture taken next to it like I was standing next to the president, you know. And I got a lot of great information from Jay, and I also got some plans that he had drawn up for his house, and went home. I flew back to Portland, Oregon, and by the time I got home, the plans that Jay had drawn up were sitting on my in my mail, And I went to work to redraw them to fit my body and fit my life and fit, you know, kind of my aesthetic. For the next several weeks, it was all about, you know, I write about this a lot, and I talk to people a lot in the workshops that I teach about, you know, playing anthropologist with yourself. Mm. You know, walking around with a tape measure in one hand to figure out how much space you really need to make a cup of coffee, and how many burners on your stove, on your range top, do you really use, and you know, how often do you really even use the oven? You know, how long and how often do you shower? And how much space does your body need to sit at the kitchen table? And, you know, from that information, you can design a space that actually fits you and fits your habits. And, you know, the downside of that is you have to be brutally honest with yourself, you know. So I had to come to the terms with the fact that I cooked and I ate like a bachelor, you know.
Like you're okay heating up a can of soup and not making a gourmet meal.
Yeah. You know, and I'll even admit there were times that I just opened the can. I didn't even heat it up. You know, I mean, really bad chef. So, you know, a part of that then informed how I designed my kitchen in my little house. You know, I have one burner. I have a sparse pantry that I shop every other day. I don't have a refrigerator, which is, you know, I didn't plan for that, but that's the way it worked out. I measured wrong when I was building the cabinetry for the kitchen. So the refrigerator just didn't fit. So I switched to a blue cooler and developed the notion that, you know, beer in half and half, what more do you need anyway?
So your brother was supportive. A lot of your friends were supportive, but one friend took you aside and with sounds like with great love said, "Dee, are you doing this because you think you're going to die?"
Oh yes, my friend Lizzie, really dear friend of mine from college days, and I was just shocked that she would even think that, and I was shocked because I don't think I had really put that together very well for myself. I was doing a pretty good job through the planning process of, you know, looking at my little house and, you know, starting to get rid of stuff in my big house, of stiff-arming my diagnosis and really not wanting to have to come to terms with my fear around it. So I think my response to Lizzie, and I write about this in The Big Tiny, is, of course not. Oh, this is, you know, this is the convertible I would get if I was middle-aged. And I could afford it, you know. So, you know, you're absolutely right. I think she was the only one that was able to actually bring that up with me.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Ron in Plano. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I have a wonderful quote I always tell people, and that is, simplicity keeps us in touch with reality. And I think that
good. People
so much want to buy into the idea of that more is going to be something that's going to give them something that they don't have in their life. I'm sorry to hear about your diagnosis, but evidently maybe the doctors were wrong or maybe you worked through, because I found myself, I went, you know, from 140 pounds to 210 pounds, stressed out and everything, and then all of a sudden, I got rid of all the stress in my life, and I'm back down to what I was in high school, and I'm happy. You know, I'm a 55-year-old man. I don't have any debts, and I'm just like, you know, I have more than I want, and I'm okay with that. And my whole goal is now in life is to get rid of it, and that's a chore.
Thanks so much for your call, Ron. It sounds like there's probably a lot there that you can relate to, Dee.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think getting in control of your life is kind of what we all want. You know, I think there isn't anybody that as an adult hasn't woken up at some time and felt a little lost in their life, you know, a little lost in the decision that led them to get married, or the decision that led them to buy a big house, or the decision that led them to work their tail off and without a lot of appreciation for it. You know, there are lots of ways that we get a little lost and upended, and I think, you know, with my diagnosis, and even as I was tumbling forward to build my little house, I was a little lost in my body. And there are lots of stories in the book about, you know, I'm hefting lumber up to build the roof, or unloading plywood, and my defibrillator would fire. And, you know, I would just grit my teeth and cry a little bit and keep going. Hmm. And as best I could, I'd feel like crap afterwards. You know, so I think Ron is right. I think he's got a really good attitude, and I wish him the best.
So what did your doctors think when you said, by the way, while I'm recovering and living with this illness, I'm going to be nailing boards together and hauling lumber and, you know, doing all the things you needed to do to build this house?
I think, you know, I was pretty lucky because the cardiologist that I ended up getting as my primary cardiologist, there were a lot of other experts I saw and surgeons and electrophysiologists and stuff, but my primary cardiologist was super supportive. He didn't want me just to survive. He wanted me to thrive. And so he was working hard to see if there were medications or procedures or anything that we could do to get my heart function back up. And the idea of building a little house, I think everyone, and probably me too, was kind of taking it a day at a time to try to see if it would actually happen, if I would actually be able to pull this thing off. Because, you know, it wasn't just that I was trying to do something and I was a cardiac care patient, but I was trying to do something and I was an inexperienced carpenter. I was a small woman with a ponytail that was easily glued to the house. I mean,
which actually happened to you.
It definitely did happen. And, you know, I wish I think the hair is buried in my house, you know, in the sheathing. But I ended up having to call my neighbor to come over and cut me free. But, you know, there are lots of messages that I think we tell ourselves about how we shouldn't be doing the things that we're doing sometimes. And that's usually the fodder for good inspiration and passion. Mm-hmm. And I definitely was passionate about trying to change my life so that I had more time and money to do the things that I wanted to do.
It started for you with requisitioning the construction of this very small flatbed trailer.
That's right. I ended up wanting to get it from a place that was pretty close by. So I found a welding shop that was in walking distance of my house. And I walked in one day and, you know, it was before. There are a lot of people that are building little houses now, and there's lots of information on the internet. And if that had existed, I could have, you know, pointed to that on the internet and explained myself a little bit better. But instead, you know, I was talking to somebody with, you know, a Russian man with English as a second language, trying to describe that I wanted to build this little cute, you know, tiny itty bitty home on wheels, and he just chuckled. He just didn't know what to make of me. And thank goodness his son ended up interceding and coming in and kind of walking me through the process. And I ordered a trailer, and 6 weeks later, I went and picked it up. And I felt like I was, you know, picking up a baby from, you know, the delivery unit. Hmm. You know, the first time I was seeing this, you know, first little step of what was going to be my new life. And it was so exciting.
But then you got it all the way home only to realize that it wouldn't actually fit in your own driveway.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm not the kind of person that's a planner, a header. I hadn't actually measured the driveway or really, I was all about the house. I was fixated on the house. So, yeah, I got the trailer home and ended up commissioning my neighbor, the neighbor who ultimately cut my hair out of the house too, freed me from the bondage of my ponytail that was glued to the house. She was kind enough to let me build it in her driveway, and it was great because it was right across the street from my house. So at the end of the day, I could go sit on my own porch and crack open a beer and look at how far I'd gotten in the day. And it was an awesome way to remind myself that, you know, it was all going to be okay. Baby steps. We're getting there.
What do you remember about the neighbors? I mean, I know that you were pretty focused, but you have some stories about people sort of walking by and looking at you funny and then continuing, and occasionally people would lend a hand.
Yeah, you know, I lived on a fairly busy street, and I hadn't anticipated that people would be as curious as they were. And so people would walk by, you know, with their strollers and yell up and ask if I was building a latte stand or... you know, a hot dog cart or what the heck was going on. And I also had neighbors, like one day I was putting a skylight window in and I'm carrying this very heavy, probably 60 or 70 pound skylight up a ladder and, you know, flip-flops. And this guy kind of is driving by, zooms over, parks his car, runs over, grabs a ladder, and slams this ladder up right next to mine and comes up and helps me. He helps me install the skylight. And he was a complete stranger. He was en route to visit his mother who lived down the street, you know. And so I have a lot of, I was very surprised and I was very blessed by people being willing to just stop and either chit-chat with me or lend a hand. And my neighbor down the street another time came down and wanted to know if I could come help him diagnose his roof. That was getting a little saggy in one place, so I walked down the street with him, and I had never had more than a "Hey, how you doing?" with him, and all of a sudden this guy is like my new best friend. Wants to enlist me to help him fix his roof. And I wander down there, and I'm up in the rafters of the roof and the roofing area in the attic, and notice the problem. And then, you know, I'm yelling down these directions to him on what he needs to do to fix the roof, and see all of this beautiful old growth cedar siding that he and his wife had purchased in the 40s for their house. And, you know, so I yell down and I'm like, "Oh, I think there's too much weight up here. We should get rid of some of this wood." And it's funny because he offered that wood to me in exchange for helping him fix his roof, which was an awesome exchange because that cedar siding was 400-year-old cedar that I couldn't afford it in a million years, you know, and I was able to clad half my house with that stuff. So that was a pretty good exchange.
We're speaking this hour with teacher and sustainability advocate Dee Williams about her new book, The Big Tiny, a Built It Myself memoir. If you'd like to join the conversation or ask a question, you can send email to think@kera.org. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Dee Williams. Her new book is called The Big Tiny, a Built It Myself memoir. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Dee, you finally got this thing built. Lots of people might have stopped there, right, and had like a little weekend place for themselves. At what point did you realize that you intended all along to sell your standard house, your traditional house, and live full-time in your tiny house?
You know, I think it was probably two-thirds of the way through the building process. And I was talking to a kid had stopped by. He was out selling encyclopedias. yes, that used to happen. in 2004, back in the old days. Anyway, he had kind of collapsed his bike on the grass while I was working on the roof. And we're chit-chatting, and, you know, he asked me, you know, what I was going to do with this thing, and I explained that I lived in the house across the street, and I just kind of sideways blurted it out that I was going to sell it and move into this thing. And it was such a casual, you know, inconsequential conversation, almost like I was just practicing it, you know. Mm-hmm. I was just going to test it and see how it stuck. And he launched into kind of a long story about how, you know, he always wanted to live on the beach with his girlfriend and surf all day and eat fish. And, you know, they didn't need much and that would be their ideal life. And it sounded pretty good, you know. I was like, wow, maybe that could really happen. And so from that time on, I think the decision had been made. And I, you know, kind of chose my moments to talk to my friends about, you know, actually selling the house and talking to my family about it. And, you know, my dad's reaction was a little bit, I think, the most shocked, because, you know, he knew that I had worked really hard on restoring my big house mm-hmm. and had spent a lot of time and money really pouring myself into restoring this 1927 bungalow. And it was just starting to get to the place that it didn't look like lipstick on a pig anymore. It really looked good, you know. And so, you know, I remember him saying, you know, why would you want to do that? You know, why would you want to do that? Your house is so beautiful. And ultimately, I think I told him that it was just the right thing to do. I don't even think I could answer him with any kind of legitimate answer. Because I must, Father.
So selling your house proved to be really easy. A friend wanted to buy it. And then you had to go through the process of culling your possessions, which even for someone who wants to simplify is not such a simple thing.
No, and I was completely, you know, I had fooled myself into thinking that that's something I could do in a weekend, is just go through everything and, you know, oh, I'll drag it out to the curb, I'll take it to Goodwill, I'll walk stuff over to my neighbors or my friends. And, you know, about 15 minutes into the process of cleaning the kitchen out, you know, with the old canned goods that had, you know, populated the back of the cupboards somewhere along the line, there's like the, you know, tomato paste from, you know, 7 years ago.
Right.
And, about 15 minutes into it, I realized that, you know, this wasn't going to work. And, you know, I talk in The Big Tiny, I talk about, you know, feeling completely crushed by having to go through my books. I loved my books, you know, and I had to cull through the books and let go of these dear friends that I had schlepped all over the country as I'd moved, you know, a dozen times. And, you know, all of a sudden I was letting go of these amazing books that had kept me such good company at night, and I had dragged them in my backpack when I'd gone camping, and, you know, they meant so much to me. And I likened it to working at a cannery, you know, where after a while you're doing this horrible thing and then it just becomes rote, you know. Mm. You just slice down. And, you know, I'd grab a book and I'd throw it in a box to take it to the used bookstore or to Goodwill. It was horrible. It was a hard, hard task. But then, that was balanced with stuff that was a lot easier to get rid of, like linens and, you know, garden tools and stuff that had a utility but wasn't sentimental necessarily. And that stuff was much easier to let go of.
Were you surprised by how much stuff you had?
Oh, I found stuff that wasn't even mine. You know, I had shared the house over the years with different roommates, you know, always keeping the bedrooms full so that I could pay the mortgage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always had at least three or four housemates, and, you know, they had tucked stuff in closets, in the attic, in the basement. And, you know, I wasn't sure what to do with their stuff. And I remember trying to get a hold of my friend Jenna, because she'd left a box in the basement of photos and stuff like that. And I couldn't even track her down. I mean, she was lost on the planet somewhere. Hmm. So I ended up keeping that box even after I moved for about a year. And then finally I was like, I just got to get rid of it, because she obviously didn't want it, you know. But, I did feel a little bad about that. Jenna, if you're listening, I'm sorry.
I think she'll understand.
I hope so.
So ultimately, you had to find a place to put your tiny house. And what you really sort of helped create for yourself was like this amazing sort of little neighborhood within a neighborhood.
Yeah, it's like a neighborhood without fences, you know. It's like the old neighborhoods used to be, where a bunch of kids would go out and play kick the can and then run through everybody's yard, except the one mean, grumpy man down the street, you know. So I ended up talking to a couple of different friends, and my friends Hugh and Annie lived in Olympia, and I'd gotten to know them really well over the years. I'd known them, you know, I'd worked with Hugh, and, you know, I'd go to Christmas dinner with them and Thanksgiving dinner and birthdays, you know. So we were very good friends. And I kind of just floated the idea out there, and they latched onto it and loved it. I think they loved it more than I did, actually. You know, it made me a little nervous, but they seemed wholeheartedly in love with the idea. And so they lived in one house, and next door to them was Hugh's old Aunt Rita, elderly Aunt Rita, who at the time was about 80 years old. And they enlisted her, you know, talked to her, see if she was on board, and she was. So I moved my little house into the backyard that their two houses shared. So it was our three houses and one backyard, and commenced redefining everything that I thought I understood about myself and community and what it really means to live with less, and, you know, understanding that living with less doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be happy all the time, but it does invite an opportunity to kind of be happy with what you have. And that may sound really Pollyanna, but I really feel like I've gotten comfortable with that being true.
Did it take a while because you don't have a shower there? And initially you thought, I'll just join a gym and shower every morning when I go to the gym. But ultimately you would use Rita's house. And I love the stories of sort of dashing back and forth in a, you know, a towel. Mm-hmm. Did it take a while to get comfortable with asking for that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You know, it was horribly hard, especially with Rita. You know, with Hugh and Annie, I was better friends with them. Mm-hmm. And while I'd had, you know, Christmas dinner with Rita a couple of times, I didn't really know her very well, and I wanted to be respectful, and I felt like she was already offering so much by me being able to be in proximity to her, you know. I didn't want to impose. And so we worked out a little, arrangement in that, you know, she'd let me shower and occasionally use her oven, and I would, you know, clean the gutters and mow the grass and make dinner for her really bad, you know. She didn't have a lot of taste buds left, man. She would eat very bland food and was comfortable with my cooking. And so, you know, we had an arrangement. There was a sense of reciprocity involved with all of the things that she was offering me. Hmm. And that made it workable for me. And then same thing happened with you and Annie. You know, we swapped. You know, I'd pick Kellen up from baseball practice. And, you know, there was an exchange going on there. And I started to realize that, you know, that exchange wasn't based on me performing properly. It wasn't based on me, you know, playing by the rules and doing everything right. It was based on the relationship that we had, that I could make mistakes and it was going to be okay. And, you know, that caused me to kind of shift my view of the backyard from being one of, I give you this, you give me that, mm-hmm. You know, kind of thing, to being one more of, we're sharing, you know. This is an exchange. This is what we do. And that shifted how I even looked at rain on the roof and, you know, how nature would affect my little house. You know, you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning because the rain sounds like fish thudding on the roof, or, you know, 5 minutes later it sounds like peeled grapes slamming into the roof, or rock salt, or, you know, there are 100,000 ways that it rains in the Pacific Northwest, and I think I've gotten to know about half of them. And different relationships with the way that I look at the food co-op, because I go there so often now, and the library, you know, the library is my bookshelf. Hmm. And I just love that there are so many books on my bookshelf. And the local children's museum is my museum. Hmm. And I love all the art they have there. So, you know, starting to look at my community as this extension of home has been something I hadn't planned on at all. I hadn't ever dreamed that kind of understanding of my place in the world would happen. And I honestly think that affected my ability to understand my heart and to kind of feel at home in my body a little bit differently.
I was thinking about the fact that, you know, we can convince ourselves incorrectly, I guess, right, that if we have these independent houses, somehow we feel self-sufficient. And even though we're really interdependent, we don't focus on it, particularly when we're healthy. But all of that is, if not simply just temporary, it's really an illusion, right? Nobody can get by completely on their own.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we never have been. I mean, we kind of fool ourselves into thinking that if we had an entertainment center, we'd never, you know, have to put up with going to the box office, you know?
And do you, when you talk about getting comfortable with your body, there are still, if not limitations, you still have to think about your health, I guess, on a regular basis? And how much does that affect your ability to do whatever you want to do?
It's changed a lot. My ability has changed a lot. You know, when I was building my little house, the idea of picking up a 60-pound sheet of plywood was not horribly hard. After I got a little muscle memory with it, you know, and figured out how to do it. Mm-hmm. But physically, I was able to do it. And, you know, that's because that was about the time in my life when I was running almost every day. And I was a hard rock climber. So, you know, I had some muscle and stamina. And now, you know, I can't really do a lot of building because it's I could do it, but I would feel horrible the next day. Mm-hmm. It's hard on my heart muscle. And, you know, I feel blessed with whatever I got. You know, I'm happy to try to take a 3-mile walk, maybe. I don't know how that would affect me. But I get out and I move around as much as I can every day. I try to be in my body as much as I can. But it's definitely shifted over the last 10 years.
And you built your house in order to move, but you're there for the long haul, do you think?
Oh, yeah. You know, I kind of conclude the big tiny with this list of curiosities, this list of things I still want to understand about myself and about the world around me. And it's pretty ethereal. I mean, it's you know, I want to understand what kinds of clouds look like broccoli spears or what kind of clouds are those? You know, it's esoteric, but it's also at the same time the thing that I think pulls me forward and pulled me forward into writing The Big Tiny, too, to be honest, is a curiosity about it and a curiosity about myself and about the world and how I can be a better participant in life and support the people around me and in my natural community as well.
What is the record, the largest number of people who have simultaneously been inside your house?
Oh, I think we have the world record. We had 64 fourth graders in there one time. It was hilarious. It was like a jar of human pickles.
Do kids sort of get your house faster than adults do?
I think they do. I think they do. It's sized for them. Mm-hmm. And they can relate to it. I think the reason I loved that little house that I saw in the magazine is because it reminded me of the treehouse that I built when I was a kid. You know, it was simple, it was understandable, and it was me-shaped. And so I think, yeah, kids totally get that right away.
Hmm. Are there any home improvements that you're looking forward to, or is your house perfect as is?
I think it's perfect as is. You know, I have to admit, I built a sauna a couple of years ago, and I use it as overflow sleeping when my family comes to visit.
They're sleeping in the sauna.
No, I do. I give them the little house. I don't know which they prefer, actually. They're kind of the same.
Dee Williams is a teacher and sustainability advocate. Her new book is called The Big Tiny, a Built It Myself memoir. Dee, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been wonderful to talk to you. And can I just offer, if people want more information,
sure,
they can go to padtinyhouses.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.